Hello, I'm Louise Steinman, curator of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. Eat food, not too much, mostly plants, writes Michael Pollan in his book, In Defense of Food. In this podcast, you'll hear the author of the national bestseller, The Omnivore's Dilemma, discuss his manifesto for our times, what to eat, what not to eat, and how to think about health and pleasure in conversation with author and sociologist Barry Glassner. This program was originally presented on February 11th, 2008. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
Thank you all for coming out. Well, let's get right into it.
All right, Barry.
Okay. So I thought one of the great strengths of your book, among many, was that you show that as quantity increases in the food supply, mostly through industrial agriculture, quality decreases, right? Quantity goes up, quality goes down. Could you talk a little bit about why that's the case and whether it's inevitable because, you know, we got a lot of people to feed and we kind of need quantity, right?
Yeah, we've just designed our food system around quantity, beginning intensively in the 70s, 1970s, with Earl Butz's, who just died last week, in fact, Nixon's Secretary of Agriculture. And there was a very interesting moment. There was high inflation of food prices, something we're about to see again, I think. And his job was to drive down food prices by any way he could. And he did it by redesigning agricultural policy, closing down the grain reserves, all this kind of stuff. And he made food cheap again. And all political leaders love cheap food. I mean, ever since the French Revolution, it's like the way to go. You know, high food prices, you know, you lose your head. So we've kind of, you know, been consecrated our food system to quantity. There is something else, though, that's I don't understand culturally as to why we as eaters would accept quantity over quality in food. Because, of course, you know, in Europe, people don't. We have always had a system, fairly abundant food compared to Europe, which has been a great blessing, but it's led to a certain kind of indifference about eating. And, you know, one of the things that surprised me is this fast food style of eating, you know, really begins in the 1900s. In the 1800s, and that the Europeans, I'm sure you've read these accounts, whenever they would describe Americans eating, they were just disgusted at, you know, these huge trenchers of food that we would just gobble and not talk and just kind of spew and then run. And so we've been eating this way for a long time. So, you know, quality, I don't know why we didn't develop a food culture, you know, consecrated to quality. I've never really figured that out or really understand that with food, like so many other things, you do get what you pay for. And that when they're selling, you know, these huge mounds of food, you know, under slogans like, you know, pile it high and sell it cheap, which is actually a supermarket slogan, that maybe higher quality food that you enjoyed more and paid more for, you might not need to eat so much of.
One way they sell the food is with health claims, right? And something that you and I very strongly agree on is that if there's a health claim, you should avoid the food, right?
It's a good rule of thumb. If the food is wearing a health claim, it's probably not that healthy.
Right. And as I was reading your book, I'm thinking, yeah, you go. But then, at a certain point, I thought...
We don't agree about everything, by the way.
We'll get to that soon. but then I thought, are we going, like, too far with this? I mean, some health claims must be okay, right? And is it ever legitimate, I guess, to sell food with a health claim?
Look, some of them are accurate. As far as they go, but there, you know, well, there's a couple issues. One is the standard for getting a health claim is laughably low. I mean, there is something now called the qualified health claim. I'm sorry, I feel like I'm neglecting you. There is something called the qualified health claim that we've had since 2002. And here's an example of a qualified health claim. Consuming a teaspoon of corn oil every day may contribute to the health of your heart. That's the health claim. The small print is, The FDA has found little or no scientific evidence to support this claim. That's the qualification. And then below that, in even smaller type, if this claim is true, it would only work if you reduced your consumption of saturated fat by a like amount. So by that theory, you know, high fructose corn syrup is good for your health as long as it replaces a comparable amount of rat poison, you know. So these are you know, very weak claims. But, you know, well, look, I mean, cholesterol, we have all these no cholesterol products, but in fact that means next to nothing because dietary cholesterol doesn't really have a connection to serum cholesterol. So there's a lot of health claims that are true as far as they go, but meaningless in practice. So I don't know what the good example. I mean, my objection is really that the healthiest food in the supermarket, which is to say in the produce section, is absolutely silent about its value to your health. And that is, and that seems a crime when two aisles over the whole grain Cocoa Puffs are screaming about their, you know, their heart healthiness. Right. And you can, you know, any product can get that heart healthy check as long as it doesn't have fat. It can have all the carbohydrates you want. But the American Heart Association will let you say it's good for your heart. And that's bad science. I mean, as Gary Taubes, a mutual friend, has pointed out that refined carbohydrates may be a more important contributor to heart disease than saturated fat. Right.
Well, actually, one point you make about all that is that whole foods have a harder time competing in what you call nutritionism. And that goes to the point you were just talking about, that if you go in some parts of the supermarket, you don't find the health claims. But one thing I found really interesting when I looked at all these industries, you know, I looked at how various parts of the food industry sells its stuff. And actually, those products, while it's true, you don't see it in the supermarket, they very much promote their products that way. I mean, one reason that so many blueberries are sold is because the blueberry producers have been so successful at selling it as an antioxidant. I think it helps that it tastes good, too. But
yeah,
but that's not true for a lot of the stuff that they sell this way. But my favorite example was watermelon. The National Watermelon Board promotes its product as being a multivitamin in itself.
Watermelon.
Yeah, and they list all the you know, the vitamins, and then they make all these claims that it has more lycopene than tomatoes
right.
and so forth. So I guess as I was reading your book, I'm thinking, well, why can't these folks participate in nutritionism?
Well, they can. You know? They just, you see, they don't have, it's an economic issue. The processed foods have the big companies behind them. They have the marketing budgets. They have the budgets to hire the scientists to find the antioxidant. The thing you have to remember is there is not a plant under the sun that doesn't have a handful of antioxidants, right? They all have them. So if you study anything, you're going to find, you know, it is food. It is good for you. There are good things in it. So, but the crops, you know, is very low margin business selling whole foods, and that's our problem. The economic imperative is to process it as much as possible. That's where you make your money. You don't make any money selling, you know, raw oatmeal. You know, it's 79 cents a pound for organic oats, right? Which is, that's a lot of oats. They're very light. You make money though selling Cheerios, and you make even more money selling Honey Nut Cheerio bars with a layer of artificial milk in the middle. And even more money selling cereal straws, this new product that kids are supposed to suck milk through. That's who's got the money to do the health claims. And what we will see, I think, is any time a crop council can scrounge together enough money, and the model, of course, is the pomegranate, which has been very successfully, I mean, here is a food that, you know, formerly was much more trouble than it was worth to eat. That, you know, now we know is good for your heart, cures cancer, and even erectile dysfunction. You know, I'm not kidding. They've proven, they have science. They haven't publicized it yet, but I was told. And the testing, what was interesting about this claim was they tested it on rabbits.
Who knew?
Well, who knew they had this problem?
Yeah, right.
But pomegranate will take care of it.
Have to change that whole expression. well, while we're on Whole Foods the promotion, something that's not in the book I wanted to get you to talk a little about is you had a little dispute with them. So have you continued? You might just give a little background for folks who don't know about it, but then have you continued? There he is.
John Mackey is here.
Yeah, right. CEO's in the house. But where's all that stand?
Well, it was interesting. After Omnivore's Dilemma came out, the big pushback I got, aside from the Corn Refiners Association, who, I don't know why, but every time I take the name High Fructose Corn Syrup in vain, they have to send me a letter and call me, but was from John Mackey, the founder and CEO of Whole Foods. And I had described Whole Foods in, you know, somewhat jocular terms, and was describing what I called supermarket pastoral, the kind of imagery that confronts you when you walk in the store and creates this illusion of small farms and, you know, happy chickens on, you know, really free-ranging and cows on grass and all this kind of stuff. But I went and visited the farms, and in fact, there are organic feedlots, and, you know, industrial organic has not quite matched the image that's on offer there. So he had one of his people get in touch and said, we see you're going to be in Austin on book tour. And the reason they could see that is they own the bookstore where I was speaking. And would I come by the office? And I thought this could be interesting. I'd like to meet this guy. I mean, he is one of the pioneers and helped build the organic market. He's done a lot of, you know, very important work in terms of popularizing organic. And so I went up to his fifth floor suite, and this guy comes out in like short shorts and you know, kind of kibbutz sandals and a stock boy shirt. And I thought he was a stock boy, but it said Mackey here. And it's that kind of company, right? It's a
so he changed just for your visit. That's
amazing.
Know.
I don't know.
Incredible.
I was impressed.
Yeah.
And he handed me this 5-page single-spaced letter of all his objections to my book, and he was really upset about it. And he wanted to take me on a tour of the store. And I said, why don't we just sit and talk instead? Because I'd seen a Whole Foods store. And although the one in Austin, if you ever have a chance, is pretty astounding temple to Whole Foods. And we talked for an hour and a half, and he was, you know, he really objected. He thought that they were doing a lot more, you know, real organic, helping local, and I was arguing that they, you know, that they really weren't, and it was kind of phony. And at the end, he gave me this letter, and he said, do you mind if I post it on my website? And I said, sure, but I'd like you also to post my response. Would you do that? And he agreed. So we got into this exchange, and we wrote these kind of, you know, slightly pissy letters back and forth. And although I wasn't, I decided, you know, rather than kind of take apart his arguments, I would just try to challenge him and talked about how much potential there was, how they could really, you know, lead on things like grass-finished beef and local agriculture, and that they really shouldn't be selling grass-finished beef from New Zealand when they could get it locally, and what an important movement that was. And then he wrote me back another letter, and, you know, it was just like, you know, criticism, you know, we're doing this. And then the end he says, but I would like to take this opportunity to announce some initiatives. Hmm. And in this letter to me, he announces all these new initiatives around local food, that they're going to increase the amount of it they have, a $10 million loan fund for local food producers, commitment to grass-fed beef, domestic, you know, all this very substantial stuff. And I was kind of, I thought it was very odd that that he would do that in the context of a letter to me. And then I realized, oh, he's using me, of course. This makes perfect sense. This is very clever. Because, you know, most corporations, if they were going to respond to a critic, would go out of their way to say they weren't responding to a critic and that they were thinking of this anyway and they had the idea 5 years ago. And you know, that's the way it works. But Whole Foods is trying to send out this signifier that they're not like other corporations. They engage with their critics. They're trying to stay ahead of the curve. And so they made these initiatives. The issue is, it's been a year now. Oh, and then I had Mackey come to Berkeley, and we did a thing like this. Although it wasn't really like this. it had a different tone. But that was very interesting too. And I owe him a return, you know, to come to Austin to speak to his employees, which I hope to do at some point. So have they? Are they walking the talk, is really the question. And I can't answer it with any absolute sureness. Every time I go anywhere that has a Whole Foods, I stop in and I talk to the produce manager and the meat manager and try to figure out what they're doing. In produce, they have really opened their welcome to local farmers, and they really are improving. And where they used to have a maximum of I don't know, four suppliers. They would only allow their stores to have four local suppliers because it was such a pain. They now have a minimum of four suppliers, and they're encouraging. And they've hired these foragers to go out and find good local farmers. So that's all great. The meat people are much more frustrated. They find Whole Foods very hard to deal with. They call it a Chinese fire drill. That they say, you know, bring us your whole carcasses of grass-finished meat, and then they do, and they say, no, we can't take carcasses. We can only say it gets very complicated. Meat is a very complicated business. So, but there is some evidence that they're trying, and not just kind of advertising lots of local food.
Okay.
So I'm generally encouraged. What I hope, though, is that other people, not me, will write the follow-up article about, if there are any, you know, young food journalists in the audience, of, okay, well, having made these commitments, how well are they following up on them? Because I've heard some alarming things, such as in someone in Maine wrote to say that they took in all this local artisanal food, jams, honeys, that kind of stuff, and they jacked up the price so high that it's essentially being used to make their house brand look cheap. Now, that would be a very cynical use of local food. So, you know, I don't know that that's
Jury's
true.
Out.
And they've denied that to me. But I don't think I'm the person to write that audit-type piece, but I hope somebody else will do it. It's okay. A long answer to
all
your
right.
question,
all right.
sir.
No, that's good. All right, let me ask you about a couple places that we probably do part company, I think. So early in the book, you say this. You say, the human animal is well-adapted to a great many different diets. The Western diet, however, is not one of them. Now, that strikes me as a claim that's really hard to defend in light of increases in lifespan and height and fertility and, you know, the usual indicators of adaptation, successful adaptation of people who've been on this diet for a while. So, you know, I don't see how that... how you can really argue that in the end.
Well, most of the increases in lifespan are really attributed to improvements in sanitation and conquering of infectious diseases early in life. It's true we've had some, I mean, I think we've had, what, 15-year gain or 17-year gain since 1900? But more than half of that came early on. And a lot of it on the other end has come through medical interventions. You know, what I'm really focusing on there is the fact that that you know, four of the top 10 killers are diet-linked diseases, and we have the experience also of watching populations adapt this diet. You know, fast food coming to now to China, to India, and these huge spikes in heart disease and this certain set of diet-related cancers. This was something that was observed back in, you know, turn of the last century by these medical workers around the world, Albert Schweitzer, Robert McCarrison, Dennis Burkitt, all these English medical workers and some Americans who noticed that when people started eating this way, this is what happened. We also have the evidence of the adoption of refined grain, 1860s, 1870s, and this, you know, all these health problems that flowed from that. I mean, that... nutritional deficiencies. I mean, it once was possible to, you know, the man could live by bread alone when it was whole grain and it was a very simple food. And then when we started coming up with white flour, we started having lots of health problems. I don't know that it's deniable that there are links between the way we eat and our health. Diabetes, certainly type 2 diabetes is clearly dietary. Obesity is clearly dietary, although there are other factors too. Sedentary behavior, obviously, is one of them, and this certain set of cancers that don't occur in populations where they're eating more traditional diets. These are epidemiological observations, and there are, as you know, there are some problems with epidemiology as a way to prove cause and effect. But you know, I think. On the basis of historical analysis and epidemiological analysis, it seems pretty clear that the Western diet has problems. We may get used to it, but we're not there yet.
It seems to me that there are two issues here, right? One is that you talk about it as adaptation, right? Whether we can adapt
yeah.
to it. And I just don't see where the evidence is in for that.
It
would take a very long time to know whether we're adapting to it. And secondly, if it were happening so fast.
Well, there is the phenomenon, though, of and this I don't understand because it's not enough time for evolution to take hold, but populations newly exposed to things like free sugars, you know, think of Pacific Islanders, Native Americans, have a much harder time and much more diabetes, and much more sudden than populations that have been eating lots of grain for a long time. So there are some differentials that I don't know how you explain that, but certain populations are more poorly adapted to the Western diet than others.
Well, or it takes a while to adapt.
Yeah, but I don't. But adapt in which sense? Evolution, or I mean, I don't know what that adaptation is. I mean, in other words, I don't know if it's actual a Darwinian adaptation, or we're using the word a little more informally. Mm-hmm. But in terms of evolving to deal with this diet, you know, look, we had to evolve to deal with the fruits of agriculture, right? We've changed a lot in 10,000 years, more than we thought, actually. We're learning that our production of amylase has greatly increased since we started eating grain. And some people probably can handle grain better than others for that reason. Milk, the ability to digest lactose, mm-hmm. not something that everybody had till right. they were exposed to it. So, I mean, evolution does happen faster than we used to think. And food is obviously one of the great selective forces. I mean, it does comprise a major element of the environment. So, but the problem with adapting to the Western diet, there's a couple problems with it.
Okay.
And I don't think it's a realistic strategy to just say, let's get used to it. Now this is our culture. Fast food is our food culture. We will get used to it. One is that natural selection really only works on you in your childbearing years and before. So if these are diseases that by and large don't hit people till after their childbearing years, there is no selective pressure. You know, so that's one issue. The other issue is a lot of people have to get sick and die, you know, to pursue it this way when these diseases can be prevented without a lot of trouble.
Without a lot of trouble?
Well, people have to change their diet.
But
is that, well, it is a lot of trouble. But I mean, compared to...
But you really think that would do it? See, that you really think if people change their diet,
I think
these outcomes are different?
Yeah, I don't know how much, but I do think that we would see decreases in certain set of cancers. We would certainly see decreases in diabetes. We've seen increases in just how many years?
But see, where I don't understand your argument on this, you're very critical when it's turned the other way around for nutritionism and for promoting things, right? Shouldn't the same apply in this case? If the epidemiology doesn't work in one direction, we should be skeptical in this direction too, shouldn't we?
We should definitely be skeptical. We should always be skeptical of epidemiology. But, I mean, we're talking about history here too. I mean, we're talking about people changing the way they eat and certain things happen. Mm-hmm. And it's fair to think that if they changed the way they eat back or ate more like people who were healthier, that it might help. And I know that when you take something like the Mediterranean diet, there's a whole lot of factors, right, besides olive oil involved. And it's very hard to separate diet from lifestyle. Mm-hmm. You know, it seems to me that, that I think that if we were to undo what we understand to be the worst aspects of the Western diet, and there's a lot of debate about that, what I'm trying to do in this book is kind of bracket that. Is the problem saturated fat? Is the problem refined carbohydrates? On the way to the evidence I've seen, I would lean more toward refined carbohydrates right now as the bigger problem of the two. I think Gary Taubes is right about that. You don't need to know what exactly is the mechanism in the Western diet that's making people sick to know that eating another way might well diminish your chances of getting these, what were called the Western diseases, because they were linked to the Western diet.
But what if we bracketed food completely
mm-hmm.
and focused on things like class differences, availability of health care,
well, as you suggest, but you can't bracket food, though. You just can't bracket food. I mean, as you say in your book, and I think you're absolutely right, class is the bigger predictor of heart disease. That doesn't mean class causes heart disease. People eat more poorly also, the less money they have, right? I mean, you know, it's the biggest predictor of diabetes, but that also has to do with the fact that the kinds of foods that are available, you know, eating healthily is very expensive in this country. So, in other words, I don't think you can tease out all those factors and say, okay, let's leave aside food. It's exercise, stress, class, all these things. Food is connected to all those things, how one eats. And also, it's not just what one eats, it's how one eats. Do you eat in a family setting at a meal? Mm-hmm. Do you have time for meals? You know, all that kind of stuff affects it too. So, you know, when I talk about the Western diet, there are lifestyle components in there, mm-hmm. no question. Eating in cars and all that kind of stuff.
and also bigger factors, right? You would agree.
What do you mean?
Bigger factors like access to health care, like the physical environment way beyond food and all that sort of
thing. Yeah, no, exercise. Food is not the only determinant.
If we change the diet for folks who are in that environment, we don't know actually what outcome we would get, right?
In terms of health. We don't know, certainly. Right. You know, okay. But if you make the kind of changes I'm thinking about, and that's why I talk about this with regard to slow food, food is a wedge that shakes the whole edifice if mm-hmm. it's done right. That's why the whole eating, you know, even if they can figure out the science and they've got the health claims accurate, mm-hmm. simply changing what you eat is not it. It won't do everything. And that's why the slow food critique of this whole thing, this Italian-born movement, that, you know, it's also eating at leisurely meals. It's not eating alone. It's cooking. And maybe it's even growing your own food and gardening. So when you really start eating in that whole alternative way, many other things will come with it. And obviously this is where you get into problems, because some people have got more resources and some people have more time than others.
Right. And so to make that more available and change that whole picture,
you have to change
everything. I think we would agree could really make a difference, right?
Yeah, you have to change everything. Food is one of those threads when you pull it. The whole world comes with it. There's no question. But you can start with food.
Right.
And you can start getting right with food. And you will, I think, find many of these other things will follow. The class issue, though, is the hard one. The fact is eating this way costs more money. And the biggest critique of this movement to reform the food system is that it's elitist. And it is elitist right now. And the challenge is to democratize it. Mm-hmm. And that's going to require changes at the policy level. Right. You know, the whole rules of the food game have to change in order to make healthy food more accessible to people, or pay them a wage to buy better food. There are a few different ways to attack that. But we're really trapped in this cycle. You know, we're in the opposite of Fordism. I mean, I spent time when I was in Garden City, Kansas, visiting feedlots. I went to the Walmart, and it was open like 24 hours a day, and it was one of these superstores, which those of us on the coast have not really seen how Walmart is selling food to most Americans. I mean, if you ever have the opportunity, they're astounding places. It's the negative image of a Whole Foods in every way. And I went to the meat section, and here were all these people working in slaughterhouses and feedlots, and this was the only meat they could afford because they get like $7 an hour, no union, no health care, horrible, horrible jobs. And there are these grades of meat you have never seen that do not make it to your supermarket. Select, or even something, it might even be something below select, I'm not sure. This meat is so nasty and so tough that it actually has to be injected with saline solution to be remotely edible. And you saw the whole cycle there. It was the absolute opposite of Henry Ford's idea that you pay people enough so that they can buy your products. Right. Here you immiserate them, which turns out not to be a word, even though I've used it in print. You immiserate them in such a way that they can only afford your very cheap products, and to keep your products cheap, you can't pay them anymore. So we've moved from one kind of virtuous circle to this other, you know, evil circle. And that's a real problem with the way the food industry is working right now. But a lot of movements begin elite, and I don't think we should condemn a movement for being elite. I mean, women's suffrage, abolition, the environmental movement, all these began among people who had the time and the resources to devote to them. And they were, in some cases, democratized, in some cases, not adequately democratized. I think if the food movement is still elitist in 20 years, we should really worry. But it doesn't overly concern me.
I know you've also thought a little bit about what it would look like to be if it were less elitist, right? And do you feel like talking about that a little bit? Because you haven't written much
about it.
You
feel like hearing about it?
Yeah.
Foreign policy? Can someone lock the doors?
Yeah, good. I was hoping that foreign policy would get in here somewhere. Good.
I don't want to talk too much about foreign policy. So. But I did. I got very involved in the debate over the farm bill this year, which mm-hmm. was a very interesting experience. And ultimately a failed, futile experience. but actually not completely.
No, not completely.
Not completely. Some interesting things happen. I mean, I have been convinced for a long time that so many of our food problems relate to the set of rules that organize the food system in America. And most of those rules are enshrined in this single omnibus piece of legislation that we call, erroneously, I think, the Farm Bill. And I think we should call it a food bill, and people would pay more attention, and it wouldn't be quite as retrograde as it is. And this really sets up the incentives, and it is designed in such a way to encourage farmers to grow five crops, four food crops, and nothing else, corn, wheat, soy, and rice, and cotton. It's designed in such a way to encourage them to overproduce because they're paid by the bushel. So there is, again, no quality issue here, simply quantity. The more you can grow, the better. It's not like you get rewarded for taking care of your land or taking care of the water or the runoff. And so it's no wonder that this is what the kinds of calories we produce the most of, which is to say added sugar in the form of high fructose corn syrup, hydrogenated soy oil, which now represents 20% of the calories in the American diet, which is astounding. That's all the oil that all the fried food is cooked in. Between corn and soy, you're talking, 25 or 30% of the diet from these two subsidized and cheap crops. Until recently, they're not cheap right now because of ethanol. We could talk about that. And until this farm bill, no money for what are called specialty crops, which is a really funny euphemism. That's what they call food you can actually eat in farm bill speak, fruits and vegetables and nuts. And so, I don't think we're going to make serious progress in changing the American diet until we change the rules of this game. And I don't know the policy answers, because the answer is not simply to eliminate subsidies to these crops. From everything I've read, it would not necessarily bring up their prices. There are so many forces conspiring to get farmers to overproduce, and there have always been. I mean, crises of overproduction are endemic to agriculture, always. And what to do with too much food has been as big a problem as what to do with too little food. So you need some kind of system to hold up prices or control production or, have a grain reserve where the government can kind of help moderate this market. But the system we have now clearly is leading to overproduction of precisely the worst calories in the food, in the supermarket. With the result is if you have a dollar, and Adam Drewnowski's done these studies, and you go into a supermarket and say you're on food stamps and you have $65 a week for a family of four, for every dollar, you are looking to get as much energy for your family as you can, as many calories as you can. And if you take that dollar to the snack food aisle, the canyons of processed food in the middle of the store, you can get 1,200 calories of food. But that will be lots of added fat, lots of added sugar. Take that same dollar to the produce section, and you can only get about 250 calories. So we've set up a system where the rational thing is to eat badly. And no wonder this is where you find the most obesity and diabetes. So how do you change that? Well, you can't simply subsidize fruits and vegetables. That doesn't really work very well because they're not storable commodities. They rot in the field if you produce too many of them. But you could, say, offer a special set of food stamps for produce. Now, there'll be people who say that's paternalistic. You're telling people what to eat. But what if you had an additional, kind of food stamp that gave you a real deal on produce?
What if you subsidized opening stores in neighborhoods so this kind of food is available?
Right. I mean,
that seems to me to be an obvious thing to put in a food bill.
And, right? That would help the whole food industry. We ended redlining in this country. Remember, the banks would not come into the inner city and would not loan there. Right. And we made it illegal to redline. What if we could figure out a way to end redlining of groceries, which in effect is what's happening? Policy got the fast food into the inner city. It was the SBA, the Small Business Administration, thinking they were doing a favor by helping inner city entrepreneurs. And the easiest kind of business to get into was a McDonald's franchise or a, Popeye's franchise. So, I think that would be a very powerful thing. I think anything to increase demand of those foods will lead to more production. Mm-hmm. So we have to address it at this national level. The problem is that the politics of food, as I learned, are highly dominated by, companies like ADM and Cargill and this group of farm state legislators. And the urban legislators, by and large, have stayed away from this issue. They kind of, as long as you give us our food stamps, we'll leave you alone. What happened this time was very interesting. The subsidy system remained completely unchanged. It is pristine. But what they had to do to save it, because there was so much political activity around it, because the public health community weighed in for the very first time on subsidies, because, you know, the hearing rooms were packed with people who were, you know, really trying to bring about change, was they had to buy off all the critics. And so there are all these new programs in the Farm Bill for organic conversion, for more farm to school. I don't mean to minimize these things. They're important. They're tiny compared to the $26 billion in subsidies. It's a million here, a million there. But, you know, they're sowing the seeds for local food systems. There's a rule now that school cafeterias don't have to buy from the lowest cost bidder, which allows them to then go to local suppliers. That's really, really important. None of this is definite. They're still working out the conference committee. So they bought off the critics and got their subsidies. Next time around, I'm hoping we'll do better. And I think we will. I mean, I heard from a lot of people on the Hill that this is the last one of these farm bills that we'll ever get through because it was really hard to get it through. And we've heard some good things from some of the presidential candidates on these issues. So now you can open the doors. I won't talk about the farm bill anymore.
I want to allow plenty of time for questions, but let me ask something from the... Toward the end of your book, you write this. You say, a hallmark of the Western diet is food that is fast, cheap, and easy. Americans spend less than 10% of their income on food. Now, you've talked a little about that tonight, but listening to you tonight and when I read this, we've talked before, this is where I think about, you know, you say, think about what your great-grandmother would have eaten. My great-grandmother... I knew her. She would have loved that.
And what
to have cheap food and, you know, to be able not and not to have to spend long making it and, you know, and not to have to go far and work real hard on it. So isn't something a little screwy when now we think that's a bad thing? Isn't there something a little odd about that?
Well, I don't know. Sometimes, you know, we get what we wish for and we realize it wasn't so good. And I think that, you know, we've had this 50-year experiment, essentially, in outsourcing our food preparation to corporations. It has been a great blessing for certain people, and people were liberated from the kitchen, those who felt that being in the kitchen was confining. But as it turns out, the corporations don't cook that well. They cook with lots of added sugar, lots of added fat, lots of added salt. It makes sense because they want to get us to eat a lot. And if you push those three buttons, we will eat because we are hardwired to like salt, fat, and sugar. They're very rare things in nature. They're really cheap things because of the Farm Bill for the food scientists to push those evolutionary buttons. So, you know, something was gained perhaps in time. We spend much less time preparing food. We're down to, I think, I say somewhere in the book, like an hour and 25 minutes for all food preparation, eating, and cleaning up, which is astounding. Some people consider that a liberation. But I think it's not. I think we've lost control of our food. I think we need to take it back from these corporations who are cooking so badly for us. And some people don't want to go back into the kitchen. And they won't. And that's fine. But what I'm trying to do in this book is point out to people the satisfactions in terms of pleasure and health in a very broad sense, because I don't construe health as this narrow, reductive thing that it's just about your body and how long it's going to live. One of the things that you learn when you study food is that your health is indivisible from the health of the soil, from the health of the animals you eat, from the health of the whole food chain of which you're a part. And I'm trying to get people to conceive of their health in that way. Health, your personal health is the kind of door that where people walk into this book, because everyone worries about their health and their children's health. But I'm hoping on the other side of that door, they expand their sense of what health means. And pleasure is part of that. You know, a family that eats together has a kind of health that has nothing to do with their cells. And that's very, very important. So what I'm trying to show people is the satisfactions of moving food back to the center of a well-lived life. That we pushed it over here, and we had all this time. And what did you do with that time? Well, actually, we're using it for home entertainment, by and large. Television and internet. I mean, that's where that time has gone. That's what the microwave oven has bought us. And, you know, maybe that's a good trade-off. For a lot of people it is, but I argue that it has strong consequences, you know, many of them really unpleasant. People say they're too busy to cook, but in the last 5 years alone, we found 2 hours in the day to surf the internet and do our email. Now, actually, we've taken some of that time from our employers, I'm sure. But some of it has come from, you know, food, because we see these minutes drop. And I'm just arguing for getting it back up again, that that would be a very healthy trade-off.
Great. I bet there are a bunch of questions. Now, there's some rules, right, that you have to talk into the microphone, right? And you have to ask a question. Yes. So who's ready with a question? Right there. Right behind you. There.
In the Los Angeles Times review of the book, it mentioned the word game and didn't elaborate. And I hope you're not suggesting that we should be eating more deer and pheasant and things like that. I don't know the definition of the word game, in quotes, that you used in your book. Would you define it a little more?
Yeah. Does game include mushrooms? I don't think so. I do argue, one of my suggestions is to eat wild food when you can. There are many wild foods that are actually quite healthy. But I also point out that there's, you know, limited resources out there, and we can't all be out hunting mushrooms or shooting deer. Although there are places where we could all be out shooting deer, and it wouldn't be too bad. So I do think hunting is an important part of a healthy food culture. And I've only hunted once. I hunted a boar for my book, and I decided after that if I did this too often, somebody was going to get hurt, and it wouldn't just be the boar. So I stuck to hunting mushrooms. But they're wild greens. I don't know if those count as game, but they're wild greens that are some of the healthiest foods out there by the measurement of antioxidants and such things. One of my larger points is that we need to diversify our diet. And we're getting 2/3 of our calories from these 4 plants that I mentioned earlier. And we are omnivores. We need to eat a lot of different things. So I'm not averse to hunting. But I don't think it's a big solution. The only wild food we eat in great amounts, of course, is fish. And we see what an environmental problem that's causing right now. So one of the interesting things is that most of the things I'm suggesting that are the best choices for your health turn out to be the best choices for the environment as well, with that exception of fish. We should all probably be eating more fish. It would be very good for us, but the fisheries can't sustain it.
Right down here.
Hi. I want to know what you had to eat today.
And you're not even on a radio show and you're getting that question.
I know.
That's always the first question on a radio show, yeah.
Okay. Well, I was telling Barry about this earlier. I will be.
This will be very truthful.
I had rye toast with butter and raspberry preserves for breakfast. This rye bread was baked. It wasn't a local meal, okay? You know, you're going to bust me on this. It was actually baked in Latvia. And air-shipped. I know. A lot of fossil fuel calories because it was really heavy.
And clearly you forgot that this question was going to come tonight.
I should think, yeah. But it's a long story, but this guy was importing this bread. He's an engineering professor, and he discovered this bread in Latvia that's amazing and has a 2-week shelf life, and it's all whole grain. And he said, did I want to try it? And I couldn't resist, and I said yes, and he sent me this thing. I've been eating it for 2 weeks. I mean, it's like this long. So, and I was leaving town for the week, and I wanted to, you know, kind of end it. So I ate that. And then it was local, actually, someone who does raspberry preserves in Bolinas or somewhere like that, who had also given them to me, and butter. It was delicious, and tea. And then for lunch, I don't know where I ate, but I was in Pasadena, and there's a little Mexican place across the street from Vroman's bookstore. Thank you. La Fiesta Garden. And I had tuna salad. Tonight, I don't know what I'm going to have. You'll have to ask me tomorrow.
Don't you want to, you should explain why the bread held up so well.
I don't know for sure.
No, I think what you said earlier.
What'd you say?
I think what you said earlier is right.
One of the things I've learned is that, you know, when you have actual real whole grain bread, not bread that's been turned brown and had a little whole grain sprinkled over it, which is what a lot of whole grain bread is, but the real thing, made from just whole grains, crushed on stone and then baked, it's very heavy, and it's incredibly durable. And these breads do last a very long time. Or it's sodium benzoate that wasn't disclosed. I can't say for sure.
Or it could be something in the Latvian soil.
Yes, or that's right. Or the
now,
Latvian
since we
water.
Can't see over here, is there anyone? No? No? You're all cool? There he is. I knew I saw somebody right in the front here. And then the person behind him next. You.
Being that we're in Los Angeles, a mecca of sustainable farming, what kind of practical advice can you give us for shopping and looking for food? Because after reading The Omnivore's Dilemma, I stood in front of the egg section for about 15 minutes trying to figure out what to buy, and I knew, like, this was crap, and this was a lie. I didn't want to support this. And I bought eggs from a company I knew nothing about because I figured I wouldn't feel bad.
Well, that's really, I mean, that's why I wrote this book. I mean, I heard that question from a lot of people. Actually, what people would say is, I'm halfway through Omnivore's Dilemma, and I'm afraid to go any further. Every time I turn the page, there's something I don't want to eat anymore. And if I get to the end, I will starve. And I didn't want to see that. You know, that's very bad career strategy for a writer to have your readers expire. So this book really is, a lot of this book is very practical tips for how to feed yourselves that I try to cast. I mean, one of the larger goals of this book is to move the ground of the conversation from science to back to culture. Even though I use science, and I'm forced to use science to argue points, my larger point is that science as a guide to what to eat hasn't worked out very well. Because the science is still very young, maybe they'll figure it out, but they really don't understand what's going on deep in the soul of a carrot or what's going on in your digestive tract either and how you metabolize food. It's remarkably sketchy so far. So if science can't tell us how to eat, and that's who most Americans have been looking to tell us how to eat, and the government with their pronouncements based on science, the journalists with their pronouncements based on science, how else might we do it? And, well, of course, we have had another authority, and we've had this for, you know, as long as we've been around, and that is culture, which is a fancy word for your mom. And, it was your mom who told you what to eat, how much to eat, what order in which to eat it. And so I wanted to see what wisdom might still be available in culture. And I've been collecting tips. And that's what this section, this last third of the book is. It's very practical suggestions. So, for example, I mean, you know, Barry said, eat food is my big advice, which sounds incredibly obvious and easy. But in the end, it isn't really, because there's so many edible food-like substances masquerading as food in the supermarket. So I have a whole section about how do you tell the food from the edible food-like substances. One is don't buy foods with health claims, because the really healthy food is silent thus far. Another is shop the periphery of the store. That's where the food that has been fiddled with least in the last 75 or 100 years resides. I mean, the fresh produce, the meat, the fish, the dairy products. By and large, there's a couple of exceptions. Don't eat anything your great-grandmother wouldn't recognize as food. You know, don't buy foods with more than 5 ingredients or ingredients you can't pronounce or high-fructose corn syrup. Not because it's such a dietary evil, but because it's a marker. I mean, what chef do you know? Or what home cook cooks with high fructose corn syrup? I don't know any. So it just means that this is the product of food science. When you get to the eggs, it's really complicated. You got your omega-3 eggs, your cage-free eggs, your free-range eggs, your cheap eggs. The ideal choice for eggs, if you can find them, and you should ask at your farmer's market, are pastured eggs. I mean, eggs from chickens that actually lived outdoors and got to eat grass and bugs. And those eggs, which will cost you $5 or $6 or $7 or $8 a dozen, which we all consider an outrage, but what I'm asking you to do is to reconsider that, right? Paying 50 cents for an egg, Okay, a dollar for the raw ingredients of a delicious breakfast and nutritious breakfast. Is that really so outrageous if it's that good? Anyway, if you can find pastured eggs, buy those. You can tell they'll have really hard shells, and when you crack them open, the yolk will not break, and it will stand up really high in the pan. It has what Joel Salatin, the farmer I wrote about in Omnivore, calls muscle tone. And it'll be bright orange. And what that orange is lots of beta-carotene. And there's tons of omega-3s in that and all this kind of stuff. So that's the ideal choice. You won't find that in the supermarket, but you will find that in the farmer's market increasingly. And someday you will find it in the supermarket. If you're willing to spend $7 a dozen for eggs, they'll find a way to get it into the supermarket.
Back there.
In the high-tech world, one of the challenges is also, you know, you get the early adopters, the elites, to sort of adopt something, and then the challenge is to move it into the mainstream and eventually into the laggards. And you started, I think, almost answering my question when you mentioned culture and how you could use that to help the mainstream eaters and the laggard eaters adopt these innovative ideas of eating real food. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that, please?
Well, you know, look, some cultures have taboos on snacking. Some cultures have taboos on eating in public. We are acquiring a taboo about smoking in social circumstances, which was acquired very, very quickly, you know, given how culture is supposed to unfold. And so that, you know, I can easily imagine the acceptable behavior around food changing. I can easily imagine, and glamour is a very powerful cultural force. And one of the very positive things that's happened is chefs like Alice Waters have kind of shone the light of their glamour on farmers. And so the profession of farming has been ennobled in our culture after being devalued for 100 years. I mean, we have a culture that spent 100 years making fun of farmers as rubes and hicks and really driving people off the farms into the cities for economic reasons and political reasons. We wanted to shrink the number of farmers, and that's how we did it. So I think the power of culture to change attitudes at these fundamental levels about this is okay to eat, this is not okay to eat, we don't eat this way, we don't eat in front of the TV, we don't eat alone. You know, we're pretty far from some of those things, but I can see us getting there. That families that don't have meals together, the people's attitude toward that might change. Or serving, you know, absolute crap for lunch in schools would become unacceptable. The parents wouldn't stand for that. So this is what we do as writers. This is what we're always doing as writers. We're holding out different ideas. We're coming up with different ways of describing things that increase the prestige of certain things and decrease the prestige of other things. And it's a long, complicated process with many, many voices. But that change is possible. I think what happened with smoking in this country is a very interesting case, that now smokers huddle in doorways outside of buildings like this. You know, we had this brief moment of smoking's okay, it happens in public, and it's gone back into the shadows again, or it's about to. Something similar, I don't think anything that draconian, obviously. Food is not poison the way cigarettes are. But cultures do change in these kind of habits, and so it's not at all out of the question.
What do you make of the flip side of that, though? I don't know if you saw the New York Times business section yesterday about Burger King, that they're doing very, very well.
Yeah, so is McDonald's,
By going in the opposite direction, right? By saying, we won't have anything to do with this whole thing, and we're going to give you really large portions of exactly the sort of thing that's being condemned. And they're doing very well, according to this article.
Yeah, well, I mean, sure, there are people who, you know, are always going to revel in that stuff. McDonald's is also doing very well, partly, though, by meeting this halfway and right. finding ways to create salads that have as much fat as a Big Mac. Great achievement. I don't foresee a day where, you know, Big Macs or whatever, what do they call the BK Whopper is going to be extinct. I do see, though, I think there is change going on in Americans' attitude toward food. And our willingness to spend more on it, I think, is very important. The prestige of organic food. The fact that, you know, Whole Foods has a very more interesting clientele than you might guess. There are a lot of very down-market shoppers at Whole Foods, as they call it. And when they're cooking for, and they like locating on the edge of gentrifying neighborhoods because they will draw from both sides. And that there are many people who will serve organic on special occasions. They can't afford it any other time, but if they're cooking for their family, they're making Thanksgiving, they will buy organic products because they feel that these are, you know, special and better and healthier and all those things. So I think culture has enormous power. Otherwise, I wouldn't bother writing books like this. So maybe it's a leap of faith, but I've taken it.
Someone in the front here, and then we'll get to you next.
Thank you. You were just saying that there's no harm in eating plants, but we're learning so much about genetically
modified... Well, tobacco.
Well, produce specifically. And I really would like to hear about your stand on GMO foods and, of course, Monsanto and their efforts to monopolize seeds and... you know, basically put patent on these seeds and hurt the farmers.
Well, I've written about genetically modified crops in Botany of Desire. I have a long section on that. My feelings about it are that it's GMOs. You pointed to what I think is the most serious threat. I mean, that it essentially allows companies to control the food chain in a way they could not control it before, which is to say that they can not just patent varieties, but enforce their patent because they can tell if someone's growing their intellectual property. And Monsanto's concentration of the seed business through GMOs and but also through buying lots of seed companies is really alarming. I mean, they've set out to control the means of production of the food we depend on. And I think that's a very good reason not to eat GM crops and to eat open-pollinated crops, you know, things that anybody can grow, save the seeds from, and plant again. I mean, it's one of the wonderful things about seeds is that you could never, in the past, you couldn't very well control the means of production. That here was this incredible technology, not a technology, but life form that just kind of replenished itself. And the effort to stop that, I think, is very troubling. As a health matter, we don't have lots of evidence that there are health problems. It would be hard to know if there were because the food is not labeled, and that's why it's not labeled. In other words, if there were some allergen introduced with a new GM transgenic crop, connecting the dots that the people who ate this, and tracing it back would be very hard to do because nobody would know whether they'd eaten that product or not. And I think that's one of the key principles of any kind of change in the food system is transparency. And we have a right to know if we're eating transgenic crops. We have a right to know if we're eating, drinking milk that's been treated with bovine growth hormone. Even if, the industry claims, well, you can't find any scientific difference between the hormone levels in this milk and that milk. And that might well be true, but you might have an interest in not eating milk, drinking milk from cows that, have mastitis or only go through 3 lactations before they go to the hamburger plant because they get so burnt out. You should have the right to make those choices, and they shouldn't, food producers should have the obligation and the right to tell you what's in their food.
Right back there, yep. Yep.
For transparency, I'll preface the question by saying I'm a high school teacher. I'd really be interested in hearing either of you speak to the links between diet and attention and attention deficit.
You want to do that first?
No, because I don't know anything about
okay.
it.
Well, they're theories, but we don't know. Is the short answer. There's a couple issues. I mean, one of the things I talk about in the book, even though I try to avoid a kind of nutrient-based analysis of this, but if you're trying to look at the Western diet, and I try to define it, one of the big changes has been a huge move from leaves to seeds, which has meant a move from lots of omega-3s in our diet, a very critical essential fatty acid for brain development and visual development, and a strong move away from that toward omega-6 fatty acids, which are also essential but are more inflammatory, and we're getting a huge, much more of them. And the balance between those two has changed dramatically. There are many people, particularly in England, where a lot more research has been done on this, who implicate the our deficiency in omega-3 fatty acids with attention issues, violence, suicide. In fact, there are people at the NIH who made these links too, and I don't know how strong they are, but countries where, you know, lots of omega-3s are consumed have, you know, lower suicide rates, less violence. There are experiments going on in England right now where they give prison populations supplements of omega-3s and find lower levels of, and it's, you know, double-blind controlled, and they find lower levels of violence. Then there are also people who believe that sodium benzoate in combination with other things affects attention. So some of the food preservatives may be implicated. I mean, I think that, you know, these are very hard things to prove. I think that if you fed children better at lunch at school, would they be more attentive in the afternoon and more less fractious? A diet high in sugar and fat, you know what sugar does to your children. And someday we'll correlate school lunch with test scores, and then that's when we'll start putting money into school lunch. Think there's a way to do that well?
Let's see, right there. And I think we have time for, what, two more questions? You're number one.
Okay. Thank you for coming. I just wanted to know your opinion on the future of farming, specifically small farms, if it's impossible to export Joel Salatin's model everywhere, but what you kind of saw it becoming in the future, specifically with the way things are going now.
Yeah, you know, as a journalist, I have a lot of trouble talking about the future. It's the easiest thing to do, but, you know, it's kind of the best of times and the worst of times. And what version of the future will prevail is a little bit hard to say. On the one hand, we see agriculture leaving this country, and that as we move toward freer trade in agricultural goods, which I think we will move to, it isn't really clear that America can grow food more cheaply than China or than South America, and that a lot of our food will be moving offshore if we let the free market do its thing. I think that this would be disastrous for many, many reasons. I think it would be, not least of which is health. I mean, I don't know if you saw in the paper today, but Trader Joe's is no longer going to take Chinese produce. Why? Well, they say, you know, nothing against Chinese produce, but our consumers don't want it. Well, there is something against Chinese produce. It's full of heavy metals, and, you know, the Olympic athletes will not be eating it because they're afraid that the steroid levels will show up on their drug tests because they're putting so many hormones in the meat supply there. So you lose control over your food supply when you do that. Other things happen as well. You lose farmers in your community, and farmers are very valuable people to have around. I lived in a small town where you always want a farmer on the wetlands commission because he really understood what was going on with the water table. I would hate to see farming disappear. So that's one scenario, and that is the global utopia of every country produces what it can produce most efficiently. I think food is different, and I think we do need to treat food different. I think losing control of our food destiny the way we have with energy would be a disaster. I think it's a matter of national security that a country be able to feed itself, at least partially. On the other side, you have this wonderful revival of local agriculture. You have people getting into farming. The number of farmers, I think, has actually ticked up in the last few years. These are very small farms. They're not making a lot of money. I meet lots of young people who want to farm. There are farmers markets. I talk to farmers markets managers, and they don't have enough farmers to supply the farmers markets. They're recruiting farmers. They're bankrolling farmers to get into it. The problems are legion. You know, land costs close to big cities are very, very high. And again, there's an issue where, you know, there should be policy solutions. I mean, we already, you know, you can sell your development rights to keep your farm going. But there are many other things we can do. You know, we could insist, for instance, in approving a housing development that there be a farm there and that the land be leased to a farmer so people there could have local food. I mean, imagine a time where, in the same way you used golf courses to sell housing developments for many years, you used farms. And then in the middle of every development would be a farm making, you know, growing local food with a few cows and chickens and things like that. I would live there. I'm hoping that we will see a revival of local agriculture and that the power of local economies for many purposes, not least health, because local food is, you know, tends to be fresher. You tend to need to cook it yourself. There's nothing microwavable at the farmer's market. So I'm very encouraged on that side. And that I think when people get a clear vision of what the global food future looks like, they will not want to go there. And that support for local agriculture will only increase. So I'm hopeful and worried.
Right. And we have one last question here. While we imagine how to build a farm in a high rise.
I read your book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, and was very impressed with many of the arguments that you made. And it sounded like you're calling for a paradigm shift to increase the prestige of food. Now we have Food Network, where food is entertainment is where it's at.
Oh, yeah, we should talk about that.
And food, historically in our country, has been much better if it's been in a restaurant than at home. And some of that is the prestige of the restaurant chef as opposed to the home cook. So how do you propose increasing the prestige of food?
Well, you know, that's what I try to do when I'm writing. That's what, you know, there's chefs involved in this movement. One of the most interesting things about this movement is how many chefs are at the center of it. I mean, chefs have, you know, historically been considered, you know, baubles of the rich. I mean, you know, I forget who the Roman writer is, Livy or somebody said, you know, when the chefs become celebrity in your culture, you're on your way to decadence. Now, the chefs have become celebrities in our culture, and I would argue we're not on the way to decadence. I mean, some of the chefs you ate with in your book.
Hey, wait a minute. I'll take you to some of theirs.
All right.
You take me to
good.
Some of
you. It's a deal.
And I think Alice is a good cook.
I think so, too. But people like Alice Waters, Dan Barber in New York, every city now has, you know, the chef who is doing their bit, shopping at the farmer's market, putting the names of the farmers on their menus, elevating their prestige. So I think they have a very important, and they're teaching us how to cook better. The Food Network, you know, I think is having the opposite effect. I think the more we watch food on the Food Network, the less we cook. It's sort of like pornography. I don't have to say anything else, right? You know, it's daunting. So I think that you know, it's a weird phenomenon that the less we cook, the more we watch cooking as a spectator sport. And you know, if we could just take some of the time we're devoting to watching cooking on television to actually cook, you know, we would all be better off. So I think there's something happening. Look, we're a Puritan culture. We have a lot of trouble taking pleasure from all the things that link us to the animals, and eating is one of them. And we've been, you know, hasty, thoughtless eaters for a long time in this country. But I think in the same way we're kind of rediscovering gardening, you know, which also we were not very good at. We had, instead of gardens, we had front lawns, right? And that was the Puritan landform, and it went with the, you know, the kind of the Puritan meal that we've been eating in this country. But both of those things involve a willingness to mix nature and culture, which traditionally in America we like to keep very separate. We have wilderness here, and then we have despoiled cities here. And we like those firm boundaries, a very Puritan idea. Well, I think that Puritan idea is relaxing its hold on our minds. And I think that in the same way you see this rediscovery of gardening or discovery of gardening and getting better at gardening, you see us getting better at food. And this willing and that it's there are incredible satisfactions that come from mixing nature and culture. And we shouldn't be afraid of doing it. So in that sense, I'm hopeful that as a culture we're moving in the right direction.
Great. Thank you.
On that note.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET.